Amendment 62 presents a choice for Colorado.
Amendment 62 outlaws the killing of unborn babies.
Legalized child killing is radical policy.
Amendment 62 is common sense reform.
62 protects women.
It protects victims of incest whose abusers can no longer simply dispose of the evidence.
62 does not affect genuine contraceptives and allows women to make healthcare decisions based on sound science.
It protects the snowflake children that fertility doctors and their patients create.
And 62 finally acknowledges the scientific advances confirming what mom has always known in her heart.
That the baby in her womb is a person.
So visit personhoodcolorado.com.
And in November, vote yes on 62. It's the right thing to do.
Paid for by Personhood USA.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I am Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
We have got information from all different sources today, but could we start with something? Just hit me with something amazing from the world of science.
Okay. So, Bob, why are dogs so good at finding things?
I've got a friend who's a canine officer. Those police dogs, they are amazing.
Really? What do they do?
They find criminals, victims. They find drugs. They find explosives.
Do they find them with their eyes?
Well, I think they have okay eyesight, but no, they smell them.
They smell them. Interesting.
Yeah, but how could they, like human beings, when I'm going home and my wife Cheryl has something in a crock pot, boy, I get hungry when I'm in the driveway. So I could smell things too, but I can't do what a dog does. A lot of them have a big snout, and I bet you that a lot of that is involved with sensing molecules.
Well, since we know the creator is the ultimate engineer in the universe, I would look at that also and think, okay, there's got to be something we don't know about that maybe we could look at and even try to reverse engineer maybe.
So scent molecules, even though they can figure out what a scent molecule is, how do they know how to find the thing that they're looking for?
Yeah.
Do you know?
Well,
because I don't know. You brought this up.
It turns out each nostril has independent sensors in the nostril, unlike our nose, where everything just comes in.
In and out. You mean they could operate independently? They're different. They're two nostrils?
Each nostril can independently sniff.
Whoa. And this is in the current edition of Creation Magazine.
So they know what direction a scent is even coming from. I mean, a lot of times, do we really know where we smell something coming from?
No.
I don't think so.
No, I just know.
You might have an idea.
It's probably the kitchen.
Yeah.
And dinner time. I had never known that. Dogs, a canine team comes in once a year for our young boys that are in Scouts. Three of our seven boys are in Scouts. And I tell you, those dogs are scary, and they could find you.
Oh, yeah.
And so I had no idea they could independently operate each nostril, and that's how God equipped them, like hunters use hunting dogs.
I was going to say, hunters use dogs to try to help them hunt.
Wow, that is just so cool, Fred. Thanks for starting out with something. It's all around us with dogs, but God is such an amazing creator that we spend our whole lives being in awe of what he's made.
That's right. Okay, so Bob, there's a blogger out there for Discover, Phil Plate.
Yeah.
And he's a big fan. He's our one listener.
Here at Real Science Friday, we got one listener. And Phil Plate, the PhD astronomer for Discover magazine. Freddie got mad at you and I because we were defending Spike Pisaris. So that was fun to have Phil Plate blog against us.
Didn't you have Spike Pisaris on last week?
That's right. It was such an honor to have him on. And Lord willing, we'll get Spike on for a whole show or two where we'll talk about the planets in the solar system and how they defy the natural theory of origin, the evolution of the solar system. The planets defy the theory because the theory predicts that many of those planets would not be there. And yet, there they are.
So what was this Phil Plait upset about?
That Spike used the word evolution for astronomy. And Fred, I love it because just like liberals, they don't like to be called liberals. They get upset. And conservatives are so proud to be called conservatives. Well, now this is the first I've seen with the term evolution. He got all upset. Don't call us evolutionists and creationists. We're proud to be called biblical creationists. That's who we are. We don't run from it. We're not hiding.
Yeah, because they say that they try to play with the word evolution. They muddy the word down, and they say they're only referring to life after a cell's already formed, and then biological evolution explains all the life we see today, because they have such a hard time explaining how the cell got there in the first place. So
right.
They say, oh, that's not part of the conversation.
Right. Yeah, a single living cell. How does a single living cell? There are single-celled organisms. And then there are multi-celled organisms. There's wildly complex organisms like human beings that have trillions of cells. And so how does a first cell form? It baffles the evolutionist because there are too many simultaneous requirements for them all to be fulfilled by chance. And they say, well, if you have just the right chemicals in a small little warm pond somewhere, Charles Darwin wrote that. He said, I could just imagine some small, warm little pond somewhere with just the right chemicals, and poof, life starts. Well, every decaying organism in the world has just the right chemicals all there in a small, warm little pond of goo, and life does not come from death. All right, so Fred, what else should we talk through here?
Actually, it turns out, Bob, we have two listeners to our show.
Two?
There's another one.
Oh, cool.
So he sent me an email, and he had a pretty interesting comment. He was listening to an audio lecture by a professor named Alan Cooper, and this guy's with the Australian Center for Ancient DNA.
Ancient DNA. So cool. Just that, because supposedly, you know, fossils are supposedly millions, tens of millions of years old, and Fred, they're getting proteins. Harvard sequenced a protein from a dinosaur.
And there's no way that that could be millions of years old.
No,
it's just silly.
70 million years old, hadrosaurs, biological material in Archaeopteryx, which is, what, 140 million years old or whatever. So anyway, it's really fun to see the evidence that is overwhelming that the Earth and everything in it is young. It's not millions of years old. But so what did this guy, the Center for Ancient DNA?
Yeah, so he was talking about an extinct bird called the moa. And it has a great fossil record. It's an invertebrate bird. They've got all kinds of fossils of this. Complete specimens. This is a guy from Australia talking about it. Whether or not the moa is limited to Australia, I don't know.
Okay. All right.
So anyways, this is an invertebrate fossil. And one of the illusions of evolution that they love to pull on you is they say that there's evolution is shown in the fossil record. Mm. But if you consider what the fossil record is, most of it is comprised of invertebrate fossils. 95% of the fossil record are invertebrates. Of the remaining 5%, most are plants, and there's a little fraction, 0.01%, are made up of vertebrates.
Vertebrates, including human beings.
Humans.
Have a backbone.
That's right.
Conservatives have a backbone. So human beings are vertebrates. So a tiny fraction of the fossil record is vertebrates,
and
mammals, and so on.
And if you've got a college evolutionary textbook like I have, just look to see how many examples of evolution they show on the fossil record from the invertebrate record and from the vertebrate record.
Oh.
From the record that we have very little fossils, that's where they appeal to evolution, because they can cook up stories by turning a tooth into a whole
race of human beings.
That's right.
Like they did with Nebraska Man.
Yep.
Yeah, that's in this movie coming out, alleged, the movie about the Scopes Monkey Trial.
When is that coming out?
Well, I don't know. Soon. It's been in the news. It's done. It's through post-production, so we'll keep our eyes open for this movie, alleged. But Fred, they took a tooth and they fabricated an entire race, a species, a civilization of apes that evolved into human beings. They called it the Nebraska Man. And Fred, it turns out that they found the rest of the skeleton then, and it was a pig. It wasn't a man. It wasn't something evolving into a man. It was a pig.
And that was like their big find back then.
The big find during the Scopes Monkey Trial.
It proved evolution, in quotes.
Proved it. And so you're pointing out this guy, Air Run is his name?
Yeah, the name of the guy who sent this email to me, his pseudonym on the forum is Air Run, so obviously that's not his real name.
On your website, evolutionfairytale.com,
we have a forum.
And so, Fred, the point is that the vast majority of fossils would have nothing to do with human beings or vertebrates.
Yeah, if you're going to try to prove evolution, why don't you go to the part of the fossil record that's
like
complete
plants,
where
like
you've got tons of examples.
Like
yes.
plants, right?
Yeah.
So he points out that this moa bird, what does he say about the moa bird and their fossils?
Well, again, it has a really vast fossil record. It's very complete. And what they noticed was they found species that were 3 meters tall. Some were 2 or 1 meters tall. They found that the females were bigger than the males. And the scientists remarked about how they had misinterpreted the fossil record because it turns out the DNA for all of these different moas is the same. So they're really from the same kind of animal.
It's the same kind of animal.
A moa turned into what over time?
Moa.
A moa. You got it.
And you know what? They lived in New Zealand. That's where they're native to New Zealand. And so this bird, it was not different species like they had thought. There were differences between a male and a female, right? But that was just male-female differences. It was the same bird. And so evolutionists, even with this extraordinarily complete fossil record, they got the moa wrong.
Yeah, and the scientists compared this to the interpretations made about the fossil species like humans, where we have a lot of far less evidence. And here's a quote that he shared with me from this audio lecture.
From an evolutionist.
From this Dr. Alan Cooper. If we can't get it right with the moa, it really does make you think about how accurate we can be elsewhere.
Wow.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah, that is so great. Because they take a few bones and they say, this proves that we've evolved from apes.
And really, the fossil record shows creation. It does not show evolution. It shows the exact opposite. It shows no change over time. I mean, how many examples on our radio show have we given of these things they find in the fossil record, and then you read the quotes on them?
Lo and behold.
This is the same as it was millions of years.
Yeah, 80 million years ago. Look at that. It's identical.
The bat is remarkably similar to...
Over and over and over and over and over. Same story.
All the time.
Right. Okay, cool. All right, so thank you to our second listener. Here we are in Real Science Friday, Fred Williams and Bob Enyart. And so, Fred, what should we pick next?
What about junk DNA? Have we ever talked about that before?
Junk DNA, we sure have, because junk DNA is what the evolutionists used to say, that most of the DNA in a human being was junk, and they said that's what we'd expect because, why? Because we've evolved, and we were not created. A creator would never fill your DNA with junk, but look at all that junk in between your genes.
Yeah, all this leftover stuff that isn't needed anymore and whatnot.
Yeah. And so it turns out now that researchers, and this is great, these are atheistic evolutionary researchers, are coming out with studies. For example, they have now found about 23,000 sophisticated regulatory genes in the junk.
In the junk.
Right.
So they find these things that actually do something in the so-called junk.
And I call them genes. Actually, they're regulatory regions. So they're areas in the junk where they are finding, you know what, this is not junk. This is crucial for the regulation of the development, like embryology, and the functioning of a human being.
That's right. It's a part of the programming of the whole process of a protein and how it's encoded and developed by the DNA and by the so-called junk region. And, you know, we were talking earlier today at lunch, Bob, about Dr. Kevin Anderson and the amazing discovery of how you can read the DNA backwards, not just forwards, to get a code that tells the body to do something, to tells the manufacturing facility in the cell how it's going to build a protein.
Yeah, it's just absolutely stunning. And this is an example where evolution severely impeded scientific progress. Fred, they misrepresent the truth constantly, and they say without evolution, we couldn't learn anything in biology. Well, it turns out that because of their evolutionary bias, they spent many years ignoring what they didn't understand because they wanted to believe it was junk. And now, so far, they have found 23,000 regions where they believe these are regulatory regions in the so-called junk.
So do you think evolutionists can still use junk DNA as an argument for evolution?
I think they still will for about another 87 years.
87 years.
Yeah, they still will, just like they use all the other silly arguments, like the fetus goes through a stage where it has gills and all those embarrassing, utterly falsified arguments. And the peppered moth in England, Bison betularia, that moth that evolved when the Industrial Revolution darkened the trees. All these arguments that have been completely debunked, yet they keep using them. So they'll probably keep using junk DNA for another 87 years. Fred, remember when they said that chimps and humans were 98% identical?
Oh, yeah. It's jumped around between 95 and 99%.
Yeah, now it's getting lower, you know. And now they're all freaked out because they're studying the Y chromosome, and they're finding 30% difference, 30, between humans and chimps. But I remember thinking, don't you guys have eyes? Can't you see there's more than a 2% difference between humans and chimps? Can't you tell? Fred, it'd be like somebody taking Alexander Graham Bell's first phone and an iPhone or a BlackBerry and saying, these are 98% the same. You say, where do you start to try to explain to them, no, I think you've miscalculated that?
Well, you know what's amazing, too, that even when they said that there was 3% difference in the DNA, when you look at the math, that's actually like 90 million different nucleotide changes because there's like 3 billion
base pairs.
So when you do the math, that's 90 million differences that supposedly evolved over 5 million years. And when mathematicians looked at that, they actually realized. And
so even if they were right, even if there was only a 3% difference, you've got tens of millions of mutations that have to happen and take hold in a short 5 million years since Lucy or Australopithecus or whoever.
And based on one of their evolution scientists, a guy named Haldane, that if you actually applied the math to it and looked how much this so-called chimp-human ancestor would have to produce offspring, it was something like they'd have to, each breeding couple would have to produce 40 offspring just to break even.
Just to break even, not to advance.
Not to, like, grow a tail or...
So let's say there's an evolutionist in the audience right now, and he can't understand what we're talking about. Well, there are billions of human beings in the world, right? And there's a lot of people, say, in China. Well, let's say Mr. Evolutionist, who's skeptical right now of what he's hearing from us, Fred. Let's say you and your wife have a child that has a mutation. Now, first, do you want a mutant for a child? Probably he wouldn't, Fred, because he knows mutations are bad, not good. But let's say he had a child that has a mutation. How long will it take for that mutation to work itself into every human being in the world? In the world.
That's right. And that's the
first of all, his kid has to have kids.
Yeah, and not only that, his kid only has a 50% chance of getting it because the mom's not going to have it,
Won't have it, and so he might have a kid, and his kid doesn't get that one mutation, but maybe he has two or four kids, and one or two of them have the mutation, so that's 18 years later. And then you got to wait another 18 years, and maybe you'll have two, three, four more. How many years, how many generations until every human being living in China has the mutation that you and your wife had when you had your kid?
Yeah. And
that's going to take a long, 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 long time. And now multiply that by millions, because that's millions of differences in the DNA between humans and chimps.
And what this Haldane actually showed was, in 10 million years, even if we gave them more time for this human evolution, you could only get 1,667 of these so-called beneficial mutations. Yet again, at 3% difference, which we know is now too small, that's 90 million changes.
You could get 1,000 changes in 10 million years. So evolution has to happen very rapidly to get tens of millions of changes in just 5 million years into the entire species, the whole genome. We say, well, why don't we see evolution happening? They say, well, it happens too slow. You can't see it. So it happens so slow you can't see it. It has to happen so fast. Tens of millions of changes happen in 5 million years. And Fred, they say it's happening so slowly, But we're not looking at just one species. We are looking at millions of species in the world all simultaneously. We should see an enormous amount of evolutionary progress every single year. New organs, new capabilities, new glands, new hormones, new pheromones.
Well, Bob, how about this article in Creation Matters? Now, this is a newsletter from the Creation Research Society that is sent out bi-monthly. Mm-hmm. And by the way, you can get this newsletter by going to creationresearch.org and become a member for, I think it's like $35 a year.
You get Creation Research Society's website is...
creationresearch.org or even simpler, CRSQ.org.
They've got just the greatest website. Who does their website?
Who is that guy?
That's Fred Williams. Fred does their website, Creation Research Society. So people could get this newsletter?
They can get that. It's part of their membership, along with the CRS Quarterly, which is a more technical journal. Mm-hmm. But this they get every 2 months, and it had a great article about fruit flies.
Oh, yeah. I took this as a lesson to my kids, Fred. A friend of ours, he was doing a literature drop for Amendment 62, and he came over and he gave us a bag of peaches. There must have been 50 peaches in this bag. And they were good. Our kids were eating them like crazy.
Oh, fresh peaches are awesome.
Oh, from a tree in his backyard that God gave that gives him over 1,000 peaches a year.
Wow.
What a blessing from God. And so there were a couple fruit flies flying around the bag. So I asked my kids to take a swipe with their hand and try to catch the fruit fly.
Did it work?
No, they didn't catch
him.
But I said, watch the fruit fly, what it does when you swipe at it. And so when the kids swipe at it, you make quite a disturbance in the air with your hand, the air current, and the fruit fly is like thrown for a loop, but he regains his original bearing so fast. Do you know how fast you read the article?
Is it like under a tenth of a second?
In less than a tenth of a second, the fruit fly recovers to his original direction, his original heading. And so that was really cool to see it in action. And it turns out there is an article, and this is in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
That's and mentioned in this Creation Matters newsletter.
Right. And that's the mother load of evolutionary baloney. And Fred, they say in here that a fruit fly has two organs that act as gyroscopes, and so that in less than a tenth of a second, the fruit fly recovers from a disturbance to his original heading. And this is just so shocking. To me, a fruit fly is just a pain in the neck. It's like a little blur. It's so small, you just see this little blur, and you swipe at it.
Well, to me, what the moral of this story is why bother swatting at them? They're going to get there. Just let them get there.
Yeah, just let them get there. So listen to this. The fruit fly, this is, again, from this atheistic evolutionary publication. The fruit fly employs an automatic stabilization scheme that reacts to short time scale disturbances. And they say that these insects drive their corrective response using an auto-stabilizing feedback loop in which the sensed angular velocity serves as the input to the flight controller. Fred, this is unbelievable. A fruit fly employs flight auto stabilization. Our engineers can't do this.
Could you imagine if we had an aircraft that could do this? It's amazing engineering, and yet it all happened by chance.
I used to work for McDonnell Douglas Helicopter Company, Hughes Helicopters. We cannot do this. We wish we could do this. A fruit fly does it.
Amazing. And under a tenth of a second, it makes this rapid adjustment.
Yeah.
I think I'll stop trying to swat at them. What's the point? Other than exercise for me.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So, Fred, we're about out of time. Maybe we have time for one last thing. There's an interview with Dr. Matty Lasola. And, Fred, I love this interview. This guy is a scientist. He's published over 120 papers. He's a total creationist. He's authored conference proceedings. He's got 6 patents. And here's the real proof in the pudding. Dr. Lasola's scientific articles are cited 1,300 times in the scientific literature. He is an expert on enzymes.
Enzymes, yes.
Enzymes. And he points out that there is no way that an enzyme, which is so wildly complicated, could form by the laws of physics by itself. Forget about natural selection. It just can't form.
Yeah, and I love his information argument. So he talks about how his Finnish language has 29 letters, and the enzyme biochemical language has 20. So he gives his name as an example, Matti, and it's spelled L-E-I-S-O-L-A, Leisola, and he says that's a specific combination of 12 letters and one space, a specific combination of 12 letters and one space. This combination is so specific that it helps anybody in the world find him. He's the only one with that combination in the whole world.
That is so cool. By the way, he's from the University of Helsinki there in Finland. So he's saying enzymes are sort of like that. You can have a website like kgov.com. Bob at kgov.com and all the world, it identifies me. He said enzymes are like that, but they're so specific. They don't have 12 letters or 20. They have the average enzyme has 300 letters in it or amino acids. 300. And Fred, just to try to get them to line up in the right order, take trillions upon quadrillions of years before natural selection could ever try to select them.
Oh, yeah. There's no way.
And that would be just one out of millions. So, hey, Fred, thanks so much for joining us. What a great time.
Oh, thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me.
KGov.com. Have you heard of the Plot Manuscript? It's 330 pages, an overview of the entire Bible. People who have read it have said it's helped them understand and enjoy the Word of God. Hi, this is Bob Enyar. I wrote the Plot years ago. We sell it at a money-back guarantee, $49.95 plus shipping and handling. And if you don't feel that you really understand the Bible now, we want to give you your money back. So go online to order it at kgov.com or call us at 800-8-ENYART. That's 1-800-836-9278.